whiskey sour on the rocks, dirty martini and a round of shots. Great minds drink alike. Great minds drink alike. Me and my baby, Saturday night.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're in conversation with award-winning Wisconsin musicians this summer. This is Great Minds Drink Alike with Horns by Altered 5 Blues Band. The Wisconsin Area Music Industry Award Song of the Year. The song was also recognized in two other categories. We have two musicians from this five-person band based in Milwaukee, and you can call in with your questions or comments. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jeff Schradel is guitarist for Altered 5 Blues Band. Jeff, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thanks for having us. Great to be here. Appreciate it.
Yes, and Jeff Taylor, lead vocalist. JT, welcome.
Yes, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Well, let's talk about this song, Great Minds Drink Alike. Jeff, why does it resonate with Wisconsinites?
Well, I think Wisconsinites do like to drink and have a good time. So I guess it's appropriate that it came from our band. But it's done really well. It's gotten a lot of airplay on a lot of national blues channels and things like that. Yeah, it's just done really well. It's a pretty simple song, but it goes over very well.
I was curious, JT, like why with horns in parentheses in the title of the song?
Because we didn't, the first recording didn't have horns.
Oh, okay.
And so we did this whole thing and you know, if you've seen the video, you know, the horns are in the video. So what we did was in the video, we put all of our friends in the video and people that we knew, and then they added the horns. But initially, the song didn't have horns. But, you know, the video just worked out so well, and it looks amazing, and it sounds amazing. And, the horn parts just worked out really well, so we just went with that, so.
It sounds like you're just kind of, everything evolves here. You're layering into this song. It's a work in progress, Jeff Schradel. Do you see it that way at all?
You know, we for our 20th anniversary last year, we added the horns and released a vinyl record. So that recording was released exclusively on a vinyl record, a limited edition vinyl record. So. So yeah, we did that just as something different to bring the song back out and kind of re-released it.
JT, you've been doing this for decades. I'm just wondering, what inspires you about the music scene in Milwaukee?
You know, we've always, as a youngster, I've always been part of it. You know, going to see bands. You know, when I was, you know, a teenager actually. And a lot of the blues clubs, you know, as a youngster, and it just kind of progressed that way. You know, 20 some years ago, I ran into these guys, and you know, just to try to have the same focus, and you know, we just try to believe in what we're doing, and we have a good process for songwriting, and we've been very successful with that. But it all started with just basically having that basic interest as a younger person, and then just trying to staying in it as much as I could, you know, with work and everything. And, you know, fortunately it just turned out the right way for me.
Do you feel like you have to strike a balance between playing your music and also your professional career in education?
Yeah, I was, you know, I was a high school principal. Yeah. And so, you know, it was difficult at times, you know, but starting out, you know, Jeff and I had the discussion. I said, well, I can be in a band, but, you know, school had to come first. Mm. And so that was kind of our initial meeting 20 some years ago. And so, you know, it's all worked out. Jeff has been very careful about, you know, how we move forward with the band and with recording, especially, you know, when we started writing songs and, you know, going, you know, flying to Nashville and recording albums and things like that. So, you know, we had to, scheduling was very important the entire time, and it still is. You know.
We're talking with Milwaukee's Altered Five Blues Band, named the best blues band of the year at the Wisconsin Area Music Industry Awards. Jeff Taylor there, lead vocalist, and we have Jeff Schradel, the guitarist. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. So I'm wondering, Jeff Schradel, you know, JT talks about the process of songwriting. What goes into that process for you? How do you approach songwriting and go through the stages of it?
Yeah, you know, it starts different ways. You know, you never know how a song is gonna pop up, but we've done six albums. We're actually headed down to Nashville in a couple of weeks to record again, but usually it starts with just a concept, whether that's a title or something to write about. And, you know, you kind of get a hook with a lyric maybe and or a melody, and then usually try to match up the music to that. You know, if it's a sad lyric, you know, it's maybe a minor song, you know, simple things like that. Or sometimes, you know, you have a riff or a musical hook and you try to connect a lyric to it. But usually, at least for me, you know, I like to start with the concept and the lyric and then try to work the music back to that. And the whole band contributes, you know, Mark Salveson on bass and Alan Arbor on drums and Steve Hubler on keyboards. So shout out to the guys. It's really a group of five. And, you know, everyone kind of has their thing and we bring it together and record it.
Let's hear some more. Let's play part of Holler If You Hear Me.
Come join the party. Let's ramble and roll. Whole lot of shaking. Gonna move your soul. Raise your head. Move your feet. Everybody now. Feel the beat. Just feel the beat. Come on and holler.
JT, you know, there's some harmonica on this as well. You know, what do you appreciate about this song?
Well, you know, it's the feel. And Jason Ritchie is an amazing harmonica player. And he was Medicine Nashville and was part of the record. And he's just absolutely amazing. And I just think the record has a great groove. You know, it's a very soulful record. And, you know, with kind of that little gospel drum background thing. Mm-hmm. And it's just a crowd favorite and it just gets everybody going. We use it as a closer and it has the desired effect on the crowd. So we're really, really proud of that. But yeah, Jason Ritchie is on the record and he's just absolutely amazing.
Jeff Schradel, how do you, when, you know, you go and record, say, in Nashville, but there's also that energy you get from a live performance when you have the crowd and you have people on their feet. How do you get that type of energy and harness it when you're in a studio and don't have that dynamic live experience going on?
Yeah, you know, it's never quite the same. We're really comfortable in the studios that we've been recording in Nashville and it does sound great. And, you know, we are playing live when we're recording. That's part of it rather than just kind of layering things. But you're right. There's no substitute for a live recording and a live performance. And one day maybe we'll do that. You know, we talked about, we're going to be in Poland actually in October. And we talked to them a little bit about maybe trying to record something there, but someday we'll do it.
We're going to hear some more. This is Right On, Right On from the album 10,000 Watts. Alter 5 Blues Band guitarist Jeff Schradel, vocalist Jeff Taylor. They stay with us as we spotlight award-winning Wisconsin music in a series of conversations. You can be part of this discussion. Call in with a question, share a comment about the blues, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
Lock off the street, grab a big old keg. We're throwing the party, gonna knock them dead right on. Right on, right on. Watch out, old Milwaukee. We're gonna wind it up. rack of ribs, spotted cow. Hey, hey, people, it's happening now. Right on, right on, right on. Everybody. Tell me, baby, is there someone new?
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We have guitarist Jeff Schradl and lead vocalist Jeff Taylor, known as JT, from Milwaukee's Altered Five Blues Band. This is Holding On With One Hand from their album Holler If You Hear Me.
Why you just holding on with one hand? Is it too late? Too late to change your mind.
As we highlight Wisconsin's award-winning musicians in a summer series honored by the Wisconsin area music industry, call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234. JT, what is the inspiration for Holding On With One Hand?
Well, Jeff came up with the song, came up with the riff, and usually we sit down and, you know, once he has some kind of a concept, just gave me a call and said, hey, listen, I got this tune, and, you know, won't you come over, and had some lyrics put together, and wanted to make just a slow, very, very, very soulful blues song, and you know, we talked about the lyrics and just kind of put it together. And that's kind of the process for a lot of the songs. But this one, particularly because it's a slow blues. It's a
slow, you know, Chicago drag, I think that.
Yeah, more okay. of a traditional kind of song. And so, you know, and you talk about, you know, the crowd reaction to the song. And I got to tell you, you know, once we go into this riff for this song, you know, it's everybody's like, you know, gasping because it's just so powerful and so soulful, you know what I mean? And so we're really proud of this one. But yeah, it just started with he and I sitting down and just kind of, you know, hey, you know, we got this song and really try to put it together. But it has one of those a really, really positive effect on the crowd. The crowd, they love this song.
Jeff Schradl, it's being used on an Amazon show, Reacher. How does a band go about outsourcing music for TV and movies, video games?
Told it's going to be on season 2 of The Reacher later this year. that's looking forward to that. But yeah, we've, you know, people hear about you in different ways, and and you know, in this particular case, someone pitched, I guess the show was looking for a blues song, so apparently it's going to be on one of the episodes later this year. So yeah, we're excited about that.
That's so cool. I mean, that'll be really neat to hear and see that come together, I would imagine.
Yeah. We're told it's going to be more than a minute segment on the show. So I have no idea what that means, or but I know the show is really, really popular and apparently has some blues music underpinnings. So I guess that's part of the reason.
Okay. Well, let's take a call now. Annette is in Madison. Hi, Annette.
Hi. I just have a quick question. I am wondering, how do you know when a song's going to be a hit versus a song that maybe won't do as well?
Interesting. Well, Jeff Schradl, let's start with you, because, you know, some of that is in the songwriting, I would imagine.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, you know, what really constitutes a hit. You know, I think it's different for everyone. I know one thing that helps with us is a lot of times we do test out songs live before we record them. So we can kind of get a little bit of a crowd reaction and just our own reaction. But yeah, when we go into the studio, we have an idea, I think, about which songs are going to resonate better and sound well. But until you get them recorded and listen back and see which ones really come to life, you just don't know, and that's kind of the fun part about it.
JT, your powerful voice really anchors those songs, drives home the messages and emotions in these songs. Can you speak to the the emotions of singing the blues and how you breathe life into the lyrics?
Well, you know, lyrics are very important, and how you display that emotion is, and that's something that you know, we've perfected along the way. But like, as far as the process is concerned, you know, we try to break the lyrics down, Jeff and I, and how things should be, how I should sing things, or you know, we, and it's a, just a collaboration of, you know, as far as the phrases are concerned and the way the song is written. So that's basically it. It's just really, really taking our time and just kind of pulling apart the lyrics and, you know, here, you need to sing this one a little higher with a little more emotion. These words, you know, sing lower, things like that. So it's really, really a pretty interesting process, but that's been our process for lyrics since the beginning. So we're pretty good at it now. But yeah, it's done by design.
I feel like, I did develop it. I feel like in a more of a special appreciation, for the blues. I lived in Louisiana for 15 years and I'm,
oh yeah.
Yeah. And I'm just wondering, I don't know how to say this right, but how do you hold that history of the blues and the Deep South and the origins of the music and the anguish of slavery and tenant farming? And as I listen to the music, I just wonder how you carry that with you in the sound of the blues.
Well, my mother, you know, I was blues music has always been in the family, right? So my mother's from Mississippi. And so it was her house cleaning music for, you know, since I was a child. So B.B. King and Bobby Blue Bland and all of these guys were pretty much all day Saturday, all day Sunday, you know? And so, you know, I grew up with that and the whole thing of portraying that emotion and really trying to stay true to the art form, you know? And I think that's the biggest thing. And I think that's where a lot of bands maybe struggle if they, you know, want to be a blues band, is whether a vocalist doesn't really have that sense of you know, that struggle and that, that real, what blues is really about, you know? Mm-hmm. And for me, you know, because, you know, we've worked on this so long, it kind of came natural to me because I know the songs, I know the history. And so for me, it's just basically, you know, trying to put those two things together and just kind of portray some emotion in those songs. And so, yeah. And a lot of times, you know, Jeff will come and say, hey, listen, you know, I think this song will fit your voice. And so that's, we really, really start a lot of the songs with, you know, how, you know, the right key, you know, the right emotion. And, hey, man, I think you're going to really nail this one. So it's, in, you know, kind of in my wheelhouse kind of thing. So there's certain keys I'm better at. And it's all by design.
Let's hear more from Altered Five Blues Band. Let's hear a part of Three Forks.
Take me to Three Forks, 1938. Roll me back in time in Mississippi State. Gonna warn everybody, tell them all what I know. Gonna warn everybody, tell them all what I know.
Jeff Tradel, Three Forks, referencing the famous blues singer Robert Johnson died in 1938. How does this song highlight his work?
You know, it didn't really intend to write a song about going back in time and kind of, I guess, saving Robert Johnson, but JT liked the start of the lyric, and, you know, Three Forks was a juke joint in Mississippi where Robert Johnson, the legendary bluesman, was allegedly poisoned. And so, you know, just song just kind of started. This one came up pretty fast and JT liked it. But I said, you know, it sounds a little bit too much like Crossroads. I sort of wrote the lyric to the tune of Crossroads. And so we went to Robert Johnson's estate and said, hey, we did this. We didn't really intend to do it, but it's kind of a cool song. And we recorded it, but we don't want to release it without your permission. And they said, hey, it's great. You know, 50-50. We'll credit Johnson and it's your lyric. And, you know, the music's pretty clearly different from Crossroads, but it has some of the same vibe to it. So we he's credited 50%, and you know, we play it live. We played it last night in Appleton. So people like it.
Oh, well, thank you both for joining us. It's been such a pleasure.
It's been great. Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for your support.
Jeff Schradl, guitarist for Altered 5 Blues Band. Jeff Taylor is the lead vocalist. This is the title track of their 2017 album, Charmed and Dangerous. Let's listen. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
Double barrel chest, Wolverine tattoo, riding iron horse chopper, walk a bloodhound dog, got all the gunpowder, one man's alive. I'm charmed and dangerous. I wanna be your bad boy. Promise you, darling, I'll fill you full of joy.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Cuban refugee who lives in La Crosse. He's also one of the people featured in the podcast WPR Reports Uprooted.
When Ernesto Rodriguez of La Crosse was 24 years old, he left the only home he'd ever known, Cuba.
And then when they ask me, you want to leave Cuba? You go, yeah, because I don't want to be there.
He, along with 125,000 of his fellow Cubans, hopped on boats bound for the United States in 1980. They were part of the mass exodus known as the Mariel Boatlift, a rare moment when President Fidel Castro allowed residents to leave the island. Among that group that fled, almost 15,000 ended up at Fort McCoy in Sparta, Wisconsin, including Erne. And while living there, Erne spent a lot of time in the kitchen. The staff were cooking the refugees American food, like hamburgers and hot dogs, food they hadn't developed a taste for yet. So a cook named Tony asked Erne a question.
And Tony asked me, what kind of food you guys like? It's Cuban food. So what the Cuban food? And then I show him like how they make a congri and a chicken fricassee and mashed potato, but not like mashed potato from here is different.
And it's in this kitchen that Erne met someone who was born and raised in Sparta, someone who had become family.
I'm just Brian Brandstetter. Ernie's my brother from another mother.
Mm-hmm.
My family was one of the sponsors of Erne, mm-hmm, back in 1980.
We are a good friend, we are a good brother, because I love the guy like he's my own brother.
Well, I've been your brother longer than not. Yeah, 41 years, 1980, wow.
In order for Erne to get out of Fort McCoy, he had to find a sponsor who would vouch for him and help him find housing and a job. That's where the Brandstetters come in. Brian's parents, Roger and Annette Brandstetter, became Erne's sponsors. Erne went to live with the family in Sparta.
Yeah, they moved into my bedroom and they wore our clothes that they could fit in. My parents would go shopping for them. You know, they fed them. They gave them love.
Yeah, Mom, she was the best mom. I never had a mom.
Erne's new mom, Annette, is one of the most important people in his life.
I told her, my mom, every birthday, she making me an upside down pineapple cake. Every birthday.
Yeah.
Sometimes I say, Mom, I don't want to dance no more. You, and she called me, Benny, happy birthday. Come and get your cake. They said, wow, man, I'm lucky. Because they give me everything. I don't need nothing. They give me everything.
Roger got Erne a job at his car dealership. And this was a big deal, since it was not always easy for Cubans to find jobs.
And my dad had a very optimistic view. He goes, oh, we'll teach him English, we'll get him into church, we'll get him working.
But Brian says once they got to church, the new community wasn't necessarily welcoming of his new brother.
My parents lost a lot of their right-leaning friends because they're like, how could you do this? You let them into your house. You let them work for you. And it's crazy. They didn't feel good about it. Our mom was a very stern woman, and she wasn't going to take any crap from anybody. So she'd get all uppity, and she wouldn't care, and she'd create enemies.
Despite the pushback, Brian and Erne remained tight. They're family now.
Because nobody does that for a black guy in another country. And I always call you like my real mom.
Erne's journey to the United States wasn't easy. He's been through a lot, but he found sponsors who loved him and cared for him. Sponsors who would help him start a new life in Wisconsin. To learn more about Erne's life in Cuba, how he served in the military, was sent to prison, and took a treacherous boat ride to get to the United States, check out the podcast WPR Reports Uprooted. All 8 episodes plus historical photos can be found at WPR.org/uprooted. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. UW Green Bay and the Green Bay Packers partner to offer a non-credit certificate course on the history of one of the oldest and most successful NFL franchises. Call in with a question or comment as we explore the important milestones in pro football and the personalities from Packers history. The number to join in is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Brent Hensel is curator of the Green Bay Packers Hall of Fame. Brent, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. So why create this course program?
Well, I think it's a great opportunity to collaborate with the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. I've actually taught a course there a number of years ago on Packers history, where we collaborated with the history department, and it was pretty successful. But this is an opportunity to reach people from not just Wisconsin, but all over the country, and hey, perhaps even all over the world, since it is online.
Part of, as you mentioned, history, part of this course explores the origins of American football, you know, dating back to the late 1800s and roots in soccer and in rugby. How did football take hold as a popular sport here in Wisconsin?
It really took place on the campuses, the universities. They'd play it basically on the lawn. The origins, like I said, as you mentioned, the origins really started with soccer and rugby. So the game would not be anything like we know for American football today. In fact, like, you wouldn't, they would have been kicking the ball more. It would much been closer to soccer or rugby than what we think of now.
Padding much different than today.
In fact, there wouldn't have been any padding.
No padding.
When American football first started out, if you wore any kind of padding, you were considered, not a technical term, but you were considered kind of like a wimp or a sissy.
The Packers were organized in August of 1919, and your course describes those early years of the Packers as a constant struggle for survival. What challenges did the team face early on?
Mainly financially. I mean, it was a constant struggle to survive. At that time, how they made money was they made money by whatever they brought into the gate. And that's basically whatever tickets they could sell. In fact, in the early days, it was called, they didn't even sell tickets. It was called passing the hat. And basically people like the co-founders, like George Whitney Calhoun, would go around, take off his hat, and people would throw in spare change. Eventually they did build like bleachers and a fence, and they would collect tickets. But we always think of the Packers as this iconic franchise that, oh, you can't wait until it's cold out or the frozen tundra. Well, at that time, weather did play a factor in going to the games, especially rain and rainfall, and they couldn't account for that. And so a lot of times, like if the weather was terrible, then they wouldn't bring very many fans in at the gate, and then they wouldn't actually be able to pay the bills. And so they'd get themselves in financial debt. And a lot of times, really, it's one of the great stories of Packers history is November 1922. The Packers are in the red because of constant rainfall in the month of November. They're going to do a Thanksgiving booster game to raise money and get out of debt. And then there's tons of rainfall again. They're talking about canceling this Thanksgiving Day booster game. And then local leaders step forward and told them to actually play the game and we'll support you later on. And this is where they eventually, December that year, a number of business leaders met, and that's where they decided to have their first stock sale, which went forward in 1923. That summer, they sold stock at $5 a share and raised enough money to get out of debt. And this is where the Packers actually became publicly owned, and so owned by the fans, owned by you and I.
It's so interesting going back to, you mentioned George Whitney Calhoun, the newspaper editor. I didn't realize how the Green Bay Press Gazette is also so much part of the origin story.
It really is. I mean, they have been a great partner with the Packers going back to the very beginning. They were kind of a PR machine. They helped promote the Packers. Calhoun would write stories in the Press Gazette, talking up the team, trying to get people to come to the game and sell tickets. And so he'd promote. I'll give you an example. In 1919, when they were just an amateur team starting out, he would the week leading up to a game, he would say the greatest team ever is coming to play the Packers, and then they beat them like 70-0, and go on, because they basically outscored opponents 565-12 in that inaugural season. So it's a constant game of trying to get people to come out and support the Packers.
Earl Lambeau, co-founder, franchise head coach until 1949. What do you wish more people knew about Earl Lambeau?
Well, really, basically, that there would not be the Green Bay Packers without Earl Curly Lambeau. He's really the co-founder. He really came up with this iconic franchise. He started out as basically the captain, co-founded it with Calhoun. And then the other thing is, everybody knows Vince Lombardi, mm-hmm. and that the Packers won two Super Bowls, five championships, but under Lambeau's reign, they actually won six NFL championships. They actually won three straight like they did under Lombardi. It was different. There wasn't a playoff system. It was based on standings. But Lambeau is one of the great early figures in professional football.
Brent Hensel, curator for the Green Bay Packers Hall of Fame, previewing the launch of a non-credit certificate program on Packers history offered through UW-Green Bay. Call in with a question or comment at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. UW-Green Bay teams up with the Green Bay Packers to offer this new non-credit certificate course on the NFL team's storied history. We preview the program as classes get underway next month. Call in with a question or comment at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Brent Hensel is here, curator of the Green Bay Packers Hall of Fame. Let's take a call. Nick is in Madison. Nick, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hi, I'm from Beloit, and I recently worked down there, and I talked to more than one person who grew up there or from there regarding the Green Bay Packers coming to Beloit to play a team put together by Fairbanks Morse, which I believe they were called the Beloit Fairies for Fairbanks Morse. And they beat the Packers in 1919, 1920, 1921. Is that a known fact?
Nick, thank you. Yes, Brent, go ahead.
That's a great question. Thanks for calling. Yes, that's actually, it's a great segue when I was talking about in 1919, how the Packers outscored their opponents 565-12. Well, they only had one loss that season, and that was actually to the Beloit Fairies. And the interesting story is, it was officiated by a local man named George Zip Zabel. He was a former professional baseball player. And if you read the Green Bay Press Gazette from the day before or the day after the game, the headlines scream that the Packers were robbed because this official actually called back three different touchdowns that would have helped the Packers win the game. But if you read the actual Beloit newspaper, there's no mention of the controversy. So that was the one loss the Packers had that initial season in 1919.
Oh, Nick, thanks for calling in. Looking at the rivalries, the Packers and the Bears, Chicago Bears, two of the oldest NFL franchises, how did the rivalry between these two teams begin?
Interestingly enough, the Bears did not actually want to play the Packers. As I talked earlier, it was always about what kind of money you could make at the gate and trying to keep afloat, not in debt in those early days. And so the Packers didn't view the Bears or the Bears didn't view the Packers as someone that would make them a lot of money, which ironically, later on, the Bears would become one of the biggest supporters of the Packers because of this great rivalry and how important they thought it was to the NFL. A lot of the small town teams would die off by the late 1920s, yet the Packers were always amongst the best teams, and so they were always supported. Eventually, the Packers and Bears did actually play, and the reason that the Bears were really looking for, they needed an opponent, because as I mentioned, there was no championship game at this time. It was all based on standings, and there wasn't like a set schedule. Like now you play in a division, and you're always going to play the Bears twice, once at home, once in away. It didn't work that way at that time. So they were looking for opponents. Maybe even looking for like an easy win. And so they eventually scheduled a game late in the season, the first time the Packers played the Bears. And so, but eventually it does lead to a great rivalry. George Halas and Curly Lambeau are really amongst the two co-founders for their teams, or the founders for each great franchise. And they're also really founders of the early National Football League.
Just talk a little bit more about the team and the franchise being publicly owned. I mean, the team publicly owned now for a century. How does that set Green Bay apart?
Well, it's something that they're the only publicly owned team in the United States. In fact, the NFL they're basically grandfathered in, so it can never happen again where there wouldn't be an owner. So it just makes it really unique. And our tour guides at Lambeau Field like to tell sometimes, well, when they're giving a tour, we'll tell this great story where they were getting into the elevator with Jerry Jones, the Dallas Cowboys owner.
Yes.
And they're talking to Jerry and they're like, well, we have a lot in common. And Jerry's like, what? We have a lot in common? I'm like, yeah, we both own NFL franchises. And he got a kick out of that. So on our stadium tours, we like to say, hey, you're likely going on a tour with somebody that is an owner of the Green Bay Packers. Where else can you say you went on a Lambeau Field tour with an owner of an NFL franchise?
I see that type of energy in the Lambeau Leap. How did that become part of the tradition after a touchdown?
Well, that's, you know, that's a great story. In fact, the founder of the Leap, Leroy Butler, who was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame, tells it much better than I can. really, it was December 26, 1993, and a fumble was caused. Reggie White, the late great Reggie White, picked it up and spontaneously tossed it back to Butler, and he ran down the sidelines, and he just saw some fans that looked inviting to him, and he spontaneously jumped in the stands and started a tradition. And they really didn't know what they started. It didn't pick up steam the first couple of years, or they didn't like actually call it the Lambeau Leap. That didn't come out till a few years later when Robert Brook created a rap song. And even with that, they didn't, it just gradually took place, and now is one of the great traditions that the Packers have.
Talking with Brent Hensel, curator for the Green Bay Packers Hall of Fame. Just a nod here to Family Night being tomorrow at Lambeau and broadcast around the state. How meaningful is that event to Packers history?
It's another really unique tradition from the Packers that's really unique to their specific franchise. There's not other NFL teams where basically they hold a practice and over 50,000 fans or more will come out and watch that practice in the Lambeau Field. It's a great opportunity where fans that can bring their children or bring small kids. It's very family oriented. So they can actually see a game where during the regular season, maybe it's not actually feasible, but it's a great atmosphere, and it's an exciting look at the new team ahead.
Well, I think we're going to have to start calling you Professor Brent Hensel. Do you see a future for this course program?
I hope so.
Okay.
we're getting close to, I think it's close to being sold out.
Awesome.
I think we're actually going to offer it again in the winter.
Okay.
Spring.
Well, Brent, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Brent Hensel is curator of the Green Bay Packers Hall of Fame. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.